We welcome legal commentator Ursula Chia, Professor Ursula Chia of Canterbury University. Morning, Ursula.
Morena, Catherine. How are you?
Now, oh, great, thanks. So that tricky old business of defamation. You've looked to a UK case and a very interesting one to draw some observations for today.
I have today. I thought I'd talk about this case that's being brought against Jeremy Corbyn. Now, people might have a bit of trouble remembering Jeremy Corbyn, but of course he was the leader of the Labour Party in the UK some years back. And at the moment, he's still an MP and a man called Richard Millett, who is a blogger, is suing him for defamation based on remarks that Mr. Corbyn made about Zionists. So this is a classic example of statements that have been made, you know, years ago, coming back to haunt a person. And there's quite a lot of interest at the moment in the UK in trying to determine whether Mr. Corbyn is an anti-Semite. And so in this television programme that Mr. Corbyn was appearing on with Andrew Marr, the prominent BBC commentator, he was asked about statements he made in response to being asked whether he was an anti-Semite. He was shown a recording of a speech that he made way back in 2013, and in that speech he referred to Zionists who didn't understand English irony, which was, as Andrew Marr said, rather an odd thing to say. But in trying to defend that statement, he said to Andrew Marr and made a statement that appeared to suggest two people had been incredibly disruptive at a meeting where the Palestinian ambassador was speaking, and that those people had been very abusive to the ambassador at the end of that meeting. Now, Mr. Millett wasn't mentioned in the statement, but he argued that he was defamed because national media coverage before the programme made him identifiable to viewers as one of the people it was referred to. So that's why he brought this claim against Jeremy Corbyn. Now, many issues in defamation cases are determined in what we call preliminary trials, and that's the way the courts try some discrete factual issues without waiting for the full trial. And it's very normal to do this, and it's the way the court ensures the parties refine and tidy up the claim, you know, getting it ready and for the proper trial. And this decision actually involved a pre-trial issue that was one of three issues, and I'll just talk about one of them. And that's the question whether the words that were used by Mr. Corbyn were a statement of fact or an opinion. And I'm focusing on this because the decision demonstrates quite nicely how working out what is fact and what is opinion can be a very difficult line to draw indeed, but the courts find ways of doing this. So the question of what is fact and what is opinion is a very important one. It determines what sort of defences are available in a defamation case. If you've published a defamatory statement of fact, then the defence you can rely on is truth. And good journalists, of course, as we know, always set out to publish stories that are based on truth. And in theory, then, if they publish statements of fact, they should be able to defend those statements by arguing that they're true. But if what you've published is a statement of opinion, then the truth defence can't be used. And in New Zealand, as in the United Kingdom, there's a defence called honest opinion that can be used instead. Now, I'll give you a simple example of the difference between fact and opinion, and that was put forward years ago in a 1923 Australian case called Myerson and Smith's Weekly, and it was said there that to say of a man's conduct that it was dishonourable is a statement of fact, but to say that he did certain specific things and that his conduct was therefore dishonourable, that's a statement of fact that's followed by an opinion. And whether you've got a statement of a fact or opinion can have very important consequences if the statement is defamatory. And the first one of those was noted in the Corbyn case. And that's because a statement of opinion may be less damaging to reputation than an allegation of fact. But the second important consequence is that proving truth and proving honest opinion present quite different challenges for a defendant. Truth requires that the statement is shown to be true or not materially different from the truth. But if you're putting forward an honest opinion defence, you have to show three things, and they're that the statement's an opinion, it's based on facts that are true, and that it is a genuine opinion. So a key question in this case was whether Mr. Corbyn was merely expressing a view on the conduct, and that would make it an opinion, or was he making a factual statement about conduct? And the judge in the court below had ruled that the statement was entirely factual, and Mr. Corbyn was challenging that. So his lawyers argued that the judge's finding in the court below was wrong because what Mr. Corbyn had said was instead an exercise of the right to freedom of expression by a senior politician in the context of discussion about a highly charged and sensitive political issue. And they also argued that honest opinion as a defence is very fundamental to the protection of political speech. Now, you often find those sorts of arguments put forward when honest opinion is being used, especially by MPs. The lawyers also referred to a previous case called Tinkler in Ferguson, and in that case it had actually been held that to assert a person's behaviour is disruptive is not an assertion of verifiable fact. So the lawyers were saying here that that case should be followed using the doctrine of precedent because like cases have to be treated alike. Now, the court accepted in this case that honest opinion was a bulwark of free speech and shouldn't be whittled away by any artificial treating of comments as if they're statements of fact. But unfortunately for Mr. Corbyn, the court also expressed quite clearly the concern that the defence can't be used as a way to escape liability for false defamatory allegations of fact. Otherwise, reputation won't be protected. So, if we turn to the question of whether these words disruptive and abusive were statements of opinion or statements of fact, the decision in the Corbyn case shines a light on the process of judging in defamation cases, which is always quite fascinating. It shows how courts have to put themselves in the shoes of media audiences and exercise judgments based on that. So the English Court of Appeal here made clear in law the answer to the question is worked out by looking at what the ordinary reasonable reader, or in this case television viewer, would think the statement was. And the court said that requires an assessment of how the words are spoken, what tone was used, and what sort of emphasis was given to them. And it also explained that it meant watching and listening to the interview as a whole, bearing in mind that an ordinary viewer would only usually see it once. The court also emphasised that if they carry out this exercise, they have to avoid any over-elaborate emphasis or analysis and give way to an impression, their own impression. So what the courts are doing here is carrying out a very highly fact-sensitive process, and they're focusing on the particular statement at issue, and the courts, as they pointed out here, are not bound or guided by findings in other cases that involved analysis of different words. And that meant that referring to Tinkler and Ferguson was of no assistance in this case. The court acknowledged the political role and status of Mr. Corbyn and the political nature of the broadcast and its subject matter. They said that's very important context, but that doesn't actually just decide the matter. They said the fundamental issue is how would the words have struck an ordinary viewer? So the court watched the whole interview and they then agreed with the judge in the court below. They said Mr. Corbyn was providing factual background and context to his much earlier statement. He had stated people had actually disrupted several meetings in the House of Commons. He had said that at one such meeting they'd been extremely disruptive, and he'd said they had subjected the ambassador to extreme abuse after one event. So the court said ordinary viewers would have experienced this as Mr. Corbyn explaining the factual background to his statement about what English irony was. And the court emphasised that Mr. Corbyn had said the Zionists had been incredibly disruptive and they were very, very abusive, and there had been nothing more attached to his statements along those lines. So his statement was bare of any opinion-like features, and that meant it just couldn't be any seen as opinion.
Goodness me.
Yeah. So it's quite interesting to see how judges have to do this in defamation cases.
It's funny, though, because they are so measured and considered, but a person seldom is when they're in the process of defaming.
Well, this is judges judging. Yeah. They have to make judgments. It's literally what they have to do. And it's very interesting to see in these cases how they explain what they're doing and what they're required to do.
What I'm missing, forgive me if I've missed it, is even though they're arguing it was not factually proved that they had been incredibly disruptive or very, very abusive, neither could that be Mr. Corbyn's subjective opinion.
Well, he made these bare statements. Mm. They were statements without any suggestion. That example that I gave about from the Myerson and Smith's Weekly case, you either say a person's conduct was dishonourable, that's what we call a bare statement of fact, but saying, well, this person did this and he did this and he did this and therefore he was dishonourable, that's where you can see the difference between the two.
The question of sanctions is interesting, isn't it? Because this is the other feature of defamation, is how much harm has been done and therefore what is the sanction?
Yeah, defamation's going through an interesting transition. It's done it in the UK and it's doing it here actually as well. It's always been assumed that you don't have to prove harm for defamation as long as you can show the statement's been made, it's about you and it damages your, it affects your reputation. Then you, as a plaintiff, you can bring a case and then if you're successful, the court will work out based on your submissions what sort of damages you might be entitled to. For someone like... For someone in the public eye, you usually get a bit more because your status is quite important. This is Mr. Millett, who is a blogger, but he's known as an observer, a reporter and a commentator. So if he wins, he'll be making arguments about what his reputation is worth.
It's also interesting, isn't it, that we talk about this in the context of a conventional television broadcast. And yet when you read what is written online about people every day,
yep.
That seems almost ungovernable by defamation law.
In media, I think, mainstream media get quite annoyed, I think, at the behaviour in the Twitter sphere and elsewhere from non-media, people who are publishing. But the fact is there have been plenty of cases in recent years involving social media publication.
True.
and so-called ordinary people are finding themselves dragged to court if they want to argue it and keep arguing it. So those cases are happening, but probably in terms of statements that are made in the media and get media coverage, yeah. So-called mainstream media coverage, is the media that's sued.
Yeah. The upshot is there is a skill, particularly to those who do it professionally, to writing with honest opinion.
Yeah,
defense.
I was reminded looking at this of David Longy, who of course was legally trained and he was a master at writing political opinion columns after he'd been Prime Minister. And if you looked at them, he would invariably set out a series of statements of fact and then he would carefully give his opinion based on those facts. And that was how he was preserving the possibility of an honest opinion defence.
A long honed skill. Thanks so much, Ursula Chair.